If you remember, if you've been with us the last couple of weeks, we're in Daniel chapter 3 today. But last week, when in Daniel chapter 2, what we discovered, so King Nebuchadnezzar, he was the ruler of Babylon at the time, he has this dream. And we don't know whether he remembered what the dream was or whether he had forgotten what the dream was, as if you know you've had dreams. Sometimes we don't always remember what they are. But inevitably, he goes to all of his astrologers, his scholars, and he basically lays it out for him and says, I want you guys to tell me the dream that I had, and not only tell me the dream that I had, but then I want you to tell me what that dream meant. And these guys say to Nebuchadnezzar, you've lost your mind. We can't do that. There's nobody that can do that. In fact, that's a job that only the gods can do. And we all know that the gods don't walk among men. They don't walk in the flesh. And so Nebuchadnezzar says, basically, I will cut off your arms and legs, and I will ruin your houses, and all of these great people will be killed. And Daniel, you know, says to the king, wait a minute, hold on, give me a day. He calls to his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he says, let's pray together that the Lord will give us the answer to this dream. But what's interesting, and we get this answer to the dream, and what we find in this picture is kind of what this theme song epitomizes, where there's this recognizing that there's more to come. It's not just the here and now. And if you're a follower of Christ, basically the big emphasis that we live by is this truth that there's more to come. And we look at our lives on this earth and it's like, well, it's going to be really hard. But yet there's more to come. It's like yesterday we knew there was more snow to come. Right? And it's just like that's the last thing I want to hear. But yet we live in Minnesota. You know for that fact, there's more to come. But we look at this idea, and so the interpretation of the dream was Daniel basically, he lays out this picture before the king. He says, here's your dream. He lays out the dream. He had this picture of this big statue, the different colors and different metals on that, and he lays it out. He says, Nebuchadnezzar, just so you know, in Babylon, you're that head of gold. There's this picture, this head of gold. That's you. And then the next one was silver, and it was the torso of silver. And he says, that is the next kingdom to come. And we know that to be the Medo-Persian kingdom. And he said, then there's this waistband of bronze, the hips are of bronze. And that's going to be the next one, which was the Greek Empire. And then finally, these legs of iron, which are basically this picture of such vicious and ruthless authority that would come down so hard on people, that we know to be the Roman Empire. And he says, at that point, when that Roman Empire is established, when those legs of iron are the rule and the kingdoms, that's when this stone, which is not cut by human hands, is going to be cut out of the mountain. God's going to cut out a stone, and he's going to strike the feet of this statue, and everything's going to come crumbling down. And then what we found is this stone that was not cut by human hands grows, and it grows, and it grows into this mountain. And he talked about this eternal kingdom that is created. And he points to this picture. Basically, Daniel points to this picture. He says, there's more to come. Everything that you're dealing with right now, that's temporary. King Nebuchadnezzar, your time is temporary. The next kingdom, it's temporary. The bronze, the Greeks, that's temporary. The Romans, it's all temporary, but there's more to come. And Daniel and his three guys understood this truth that there was more to come. And this morning what we encounter in Daniel chapter 3 steps into more of that understanding where we see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In a very familiar story, we look at Daniel, and I was talking to some of you about this. We're very accustomed, especially in these first six chapters of Daniel, we've heard these stories since we were very young. You know, these are some of those stories where you learn that eating meat is bad, eating vegetables is good. These are some of those stories where you know about the fiery furnace, you hear about Daniel in the lion's den, you hear about the writing on the wall. These are all stories that we share about in Sunday school, we're very accustomed to. But I think in that capacity, we've become so accustomed, like the Christmas story, we become so accustomed to it, we kind of lose some of its impact. And so as I've been wrestling with this, I want us to understand the characters. So obviously there's Nebuchadnezzar, you got Daniel, you got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're kind of three different characters, but they kind of epitomize one. And then you have the main character we saw last week. Who's the main character? It wasn't Nebuchadnezzar, it wasn't Daniel, it wasn't Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It was God, who's doing that which only he could do, striking the statue with that rock. He was the main character. And so those are kind of the characters that we keep encountering, and this week we encounter Nebuchadnezzar as well. But I want us to look at this. We oftentimes kind of focus on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we look at these three guys, oh, they're so great guys, they're such men of faith. That is true, and we should, in fact, aspire to be like these guys with great faith. But yet, if I'm going to be honest and we take some time to reflect, who am I? I reflect as to what is it that I am like. Am I like these guys? Not really. If I was faced with the fire, would I make the decision that they did? I hope so. But yet, would I? That's left to be decided until that moment, I suppose. But I would like to say that I would. But we look at the character of Nebuchadnezzar, who we saw last week was confronted with this amazing picture of God Almighty, who this great God was. He even acknowledged to Daniel, "Daniel, your God is so great and powerful. That's amazing." And yet what we see in Nebuchadnezzar is someone who does not follow that God. And we find someone who's in awe, but not repentant. Someone who's in awe, but not following. And we concluded last week that we need to, yeah, be in awe of who God is, but let that awe be something that transforms us, that we're not the same person thereafter. And so we see more evidence of that this morning. And so when we look at Nebuchadnezzar, here's what I found is this reality of pride. Nebuchadnezzar is a very proud man. Last week we saw it with Daniel. He's like, he's got this control over everyone. He says, if you can't tell me what my dream was and what my dream meant, I have great pride. I'm lofty enough. I'm important enough. I disregard life enough where I will just have you all killed. I can go into another nation and find some other wise guys to bring back with me and train up. I don't need you that much. And so there's this lofty pride that he sees himself as almighty in a sense. And Daniel points out to him that there's someone who's greater than you. But yet he also said that you are that head of gold. And we're going to look at that a little bit further this morning. A little quote by C.S. Lewis as we get started dealing with this idea of pride. And this is what C.S. Lewis says. He says, according to the Christian teachers, the essential vice, the utmost evil, is pride. And consider this, what he has to say to unpack that a little bit. He says, unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all that are mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. It is pride which has been the chief cause of misery in every nation and every family since the world began. Since you look at the idea of pride, back in Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve in the garden, Satan approaches them, and how does he appeal to their temptation? How does he tempt them? It's with pride. You can be like God if you will just eat of this fruit. You know, and we all have a sense where we, in a sense, want to be deity. We want to be godlike. When you're driving down the highway and someone cuts you off and you get angry, that's really pointing to the fact that you have pride, thinking, how dare you cut me off? You have no right, no business to just treat me the way that you did. And you've taken yourself and you've elevated yourself in a position that's higher than it ought to be and higher certainly than they are. We have it all the time. Siblings, and you're fighting. It happens. You know that it happens. And in the midst of that, it's basically the conflict comes because you see yourself as being loftier than the other person. It's pride. It happens over and over and over again. Pride is everywhere. We are Americans, and we are proud of our nation. And not only there's elements that that is okay, but in that capacity, we build ourselves up and we become godlike, where we want what we want. Get out of my way. I deserve to have what I want. Our media pushes it. It's all over the place. But pride is something that we don't acknowledge well enough. And when we look at Nebuchadnezzar, we see his pride. And if I'm going to be honest, I got to look at that and say, wow, I got something I got to deal with here. And that's pride. Every one of us should be able to look at Nebuchadnezzar here this morning, try to parallel yourself with it. Yes, he's going to be a little bit hyperbolic in the sense of he's pretty exaggerated in that sense. However, I think we should see a little bit of ourselves in Nebuchadnezzar. Watch how he reacts. And then next week, it's really cool with what God does with Nebuchadnezzar in that sense. So pride, it's obviously a big issue. So as we get started here, what we find that Nebuchadnezzar was not able to do, he was presented with awe of who God is. And as he was confronted with this awe, man, this God is amazing, this God is mighty, this God is powerful. And yet it's like, wow, that's really cool. Neat trick, Daniel. But now how does that affect me? Yeah, I'm still pretty lofty in my own light. I don't think I need to do anything else with that. And this is what we find in Colossians 3 that Nebuchadnezzar has not done. He has not repented. He has not turned. But in here what we see is Paul points to us, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to the earthly nature. When you're presented with what God has to say, when you're presented with the truth, then take that sin, take that which belongs to the earthly nature, that pride, and kill it. C.S. Lewis also writes in The Great Divorce, one of my favorite stories, but he's got this scene in The Great Divorce where there's this man, The Great Divorce, if you haven't read it, it's basically this picture of people going to heaven, in a sense, on a bus. And as they get there, there's one character in particular, he's got a lizard on his shoulder. And as he's confronted with this lizard on his shoulder, which represents sin in his life, the man who he's interacting with, is like he wants to get into, to cross over into heaven, and the man that he's dealing with says, you can't come with that lizard on your shoulder, you have to kill it. He says, well, it's been there a long time, I don't know that I really want to do that. He says, you have to kill it, you have to kill it, you have to kill it. Finally, the man with the lizard on his shoulder allows the man to take it and kill it. It's putting to death that which belongs to the sinful nature. And if we're going to be honest and look at Nebuchadnezzar, he had great respect and understood the power that God had. But when it came time to put to death that which he would have been confronted was wrong, he wasn't willing to do that. And that's what I can align myself with in looking at Nebuchadnezzar. Because it's really pretty easy for me to see, wow, God is amazing. God is powerful. But that means that I have to do some changes. Now that's where it gets to be difficult. Because I got a lizard on my shoulder that I'd rather not kill. So Paul says, put to death, therefore, with whatever belongs to the earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. So then we start in Daniel chapter 3. This is where it gets to be kind of fun and kind of exciting. I want you to pay special attention to several things as we go through Daniel chapter 3. We won't hit every verse. We're going to catch the main theme. We're going to catch the main story. But pay attention to Nebuchadnezzar. Pay attention to his pride. Pay attention to that which he sees and is awestruck by. Pay attention to the faith and the trust that these three guys will have in the midst of this story. But in this capacity, understand these three guys who are about to be delivered, God is no less faithful. God is no less awe-striking. He's no less glorified if they haven't been spared. I mean, you have to understand that in this story, because this is the main character here. Yeah, he spares these three guys, and that's a great thing. But even in the midst of that, if through this fiery trial they lose their lives, God is no less glorified from it. So let's look at it. So King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. It's interesting. When we look at this idea of image of gold, we saw it in chapter 2. Daniel gave him the idea, I think. I think with this idea of, here's the thing, Nebuchadnezzar, you saw in your dream this great statue, this head of gold, that was you. I think it was kind of somehow inspired Nebuchadnezzar to say, wow, I'm this head of gold. I'm going to make a whole statue of gold, and then I'm going to have everyone worship it. We don't know exactly what the image was. However, there's some speculation, and it could be a number of different images that are reflected with this statue. It could be that Nebuchadnezzar has made an image of the god Nabu, which is his name is derived from Nebuchadnezzar. And so it could be the image of this idol, this god person that they had. It could be that Nebuchadnezzar has literally made a statue of himself. That is possible. In either case, it's elevated, it's made of gold, it is likely gold-plated, it is not solid gold, as wealthy as he was, a solid gold statue, 90 feet tall, which is what this equates to be, which is probably the height of a full adult-grown silver maple tree. I mean, that's pretty tall. You can imagine that out in a field. So we take it down into the plain of Dura, which had been south of Babylon a short distance, but it's open. And so out of nowhere, here comes this statue of gold, perhaps inspired by Daniel's image that he had interpreted for Nebuchadnezzar, understanding what he was. Whether it's a statue of him, whether it's a statue of the Nabu, the god that his name is after, it doesn't really matter. It's basically pointing back to Nebuchadnezzar, because his name epitomizes the god. The statue would be him or the god. It doesn't make any difference. In a sense, it's saying, look at this great Nebuchadnezzar, in a way. And then what he ends up doing, he sets up the statue. It's 90 feet tall, about 9 feet by 9 feet in its base. And then he summoned, and notice the list, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all other provincial officials. These are all the rulers. I mean, and there's some are small. It'd be in the same sense as what we're saying. We got mayors, we got governors, we got sheriffs. All of these people that have some kind of officiating capacity were invited, in fact, mandated to come before this statue and to start worshiping it. So these are all the officials. When the officials come to do that, then they would also, it's like the same thing we saw in chapter 1, where you have Nebuchadnezzar pulling in all these wise people, conforming them to their thinking. That way they can lead everyone else into that thinking. It's almost like Marxism in a way. It's almost a brainwashing that's intended to get everyone conformed to one mindset, one thinking, one uniformity. And so he brings in all of these officials so that they can dedicate the image that he had set up. The idea of the dedication is very religious in its capacity. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 6. This is a picture of Solomon dedicating the temple. So notice the language. This is similar to what Nebuchadnezzar is after. He actually wants this statue to be dedicated as a religious service. So then Solomon, after he had finished the temple, he stood before the altar of the Lord in front of the whole assembly of Israel. He spread out his hands. He said, now he had made the bronze platform 5 cubits long by 5 cubits wide and 3 cubits high, and he had placed on it in the center of the outer court. He stood on the platform, and then he knelt down before the whole assembly of Israel and spread out his hands towards heaven. And this is what he prayed. He said, Lord, the God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven and on earth. Notice the contrast, what we see here versus what we will see with the statue. You keep your covenant of love with your servants who continue wholeheartedly in your way. And what a prayer. And it goes on much longer, but this is how he starts the prayer. God, you are above all things. You are the God of gods. You are the King of kings. And you have kept your covenant of love. Dear people, this idol, this statue, there is no love in this idol. There's no love in this statue. We see it in Deuteronomy chapter 4. You see it in Psalms. You see it in Isaiah. But there's this picture that God says, what idol can see? What idol can smell? They can do nothing. And Nebuchadnezzar is asking these people to worship a golden statue that can't see, that can't smell, that can't lift an arm, can't do anything. And here you have Solomon recognizing God for who he is, kneels down, raises his hands up before all of Israel. And he says, God, you are amazing. God, you are above all things. You are God of God. Your covenant of love that's given to us, it's just remarkable. So down to chapter 3 and verse 5 then he says, so as soon as Nebuchadnezzar says to all of his leaders, as soon as you hear the music, okay? As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, it's interesting, all of these instruments were to come from all kinds of different areas, okay? Middle Eastern areas, but in the same sense, so they've incorporated all of these different languages, they've incorporated all of these different cultures into one, and they're making it Babylonian, if you will. So they pull in all this stuff, so people would recognize the sounds of the harp, they would recognize the sounds of the zither, they'd recognize the sounds of the lyre, and it's like, wow, I know that instrument, that's part of my heritage, and they're all playing, making this music, and when they hear the music, what do they have to do? They have to fall down and worship, which is that word shakah, except this is in Aramaic, so it's not a literal translation in that sense, but it's the same idea. The word shakah is to recognize, oh, you are greater than I am. I submit myself under you. So I'm down here. You are up there. You are called to, when you hear the music, prostrate yourself below the statue. So worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will be immediately thrown into a blazing furnace. It's the same, basically, lack of any kind of restraint from Nebuchadnezzar. He tends to fly off the handle. We saw it. He's very hostile. We saw it last week when people would not choose to interpret the dream for him. He said, I will rip your arms and legs off, and then I will destroy your homes, as if you need a home after your arms and legs have been ripped off. But it's a little extreme, but this is who he is. So he says, I'll throw you into the blazing furnace. Therefore, as soon as they heard the music, the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations, remember, he's got a whole mess of different nations that he's already conquered. He's bringing them in. He brings in their wise guys. They gather together. Nations, tongues, peoples of every language fell and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. They recognized this threat as being legitimate. They believe that Nebuchadnezzar would do what it is that he said he would do, and they choose to fall down and worship an idol that cannot see, an idol that cannot smell, an idol that cannot hear, and an idol that cannot even do anything and move his arms. It's interesting when we look at this contrast. If you remember your Old Testament history, particularly in Exodus 32, Moses had led the people out of Egypt. They come to the base of Mount Sinai, and Moses goes up. All of the Israelites are still down there. Only Moses is up. Remember, Aaron was one of them that helped lead the Israelites out. The Israelites go to Aaron. They say, Moses has been gone a long time. I think he's dead. let's make a golden idol that we can worship, an idol that cannot see, an idol that cannot hear, an idol that cannot taste, an idol that cannot smell, an idol that cannot move, so that we can worship that. So they tell Aaron, can we do that for us? So he took, Aaron, took what they had handed him, and he made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then he said, these, just astounding. Consider this versus Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These are your gods, small g, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord. So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Verse 8, they have been quick to turn away. This is God talking to Moses now. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. Moses is still up on the mountain. God's saying, go back down. Guess what they did? They have bowed down to this idol. They have sacrificed to it and have said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Understand the contrast that we're looking at here. Both have a golden idol. The Israelites as a corporate group, whether falling to peer pressure, I don't know what it was, but recognizes like, I'd rather worship a God that can't speak, can't smell, can't hear, can't do anything, because then maybe I get to control it. Because that kind of puts me, I made this God. Do you see that? I made this idol. Nebuchadnezzar made this statue of gold. If I can control who God is, that elevates me, that pride, then I become the deity. Well, guess what? God is not a God that we can control. And we should worship a God that we cannot control. Verse 8, and followed by verse 12. So at this time, it's very interesting. So here's the thing. All of these rulers, all these leaders who Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have been some of the ones that would have been required to do that which the king has asked to be done. The city of Babylon at the time is about 200,000 people. Not all of them, but it appears, were actually said, hey, you have to come down and worship the idol. It was only the leaders is what was stated. That does not mean that that influence wouldn't have spread then to the rest of the 200,000 people in Babylon. So at this time, some astrologers, also known as Chaldeans, your Bible may refer to Chaldeans, but it's astrologers, it's astronomers, it's those who study the stars, which is very interesting. You look at what Daniel said last week in the interpretation of the dream. These are a bunch of people that study stars. If you remember the wise men, they came from the east somewhere. They likely would have had the resource of what Daniel had put in a sense, what he wrote in his book. We're going to see that more as we continue on through the book of Daniel. So it's very interesting. That probably would have been one of his sources or one of their sources that they would have looked at before they came to see the Christ child. So at this time, some of these Chaldeans, these astrologers, came forward and denounced the Jews. The word denounced, it's a wonderful word. You know what that means? Literally means to be chewed up. These Chaldeans come and they chew up these Jews. In other words, they're just, bad mouthing is one word, but it's just like they are tearing into them as if they were chewing them up and just mashing them to pieces. It's a fascinating picture. But there are some Jews whom you have set on the affairs of the province of Babylon. In other words, there are some Jews who are leaders. You have put them, you have promoted them into leadership. You've set them over some of these affairs in the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty, which is not true. They did pay attention to the king, and they served the king very well. But these Chaldeans who hated the Jews, obviously, they're probably very likely jealous of them because they are foreigners that have been promoted higher than they are. Pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold that you have set up. That is true. That part is an accurate statement. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned these three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true? Tell me the answer, okay? Here's the question. Is it true, you three, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I've set up? Do you have any idea how many people I had work on that statue, and now you will not bow down to this gold statue that I've set up? It's my rule. I'm God in a sense. I am the one that gets to decide, and you think you're going to disobey that? Is it true that you have not done that? Verse 15, this is amazing. Now, I'm going to give you another chance. Okay, yes, I said it and I meant what I said, where if you don't do it, you will immediately be thrown in the furnace. However, guys, you guys have been really good to me. You've served me well. I'm going to give you another chance. Now when you hear the music of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, you, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. I'll let you off the hook. But if you do not worship it, you'll be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. I love this. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? You see what Nebuchadnezzar is doing? He's putting himself in this, like, I control this. This is my doing. There is no one but me who gets to decide right now whether you live or whether you die. It relies solely on me. I get to decide. The response. The king talked with them. Okay, this is backing up. This just shows a little bit as to how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have been in the king's favor and, in fact, have been promoted. So this is obviously when they had gone in their study and they had done their learning, and the king recognized them. There's no one like these guys. These guys are sharp. These guys have served Babylon well. And in chapter 2, we see this is where they get promoted. After they had prayed with Daniel, Daniel recommends that, hey, guys, King Nebuchadnezzar, you should really promote these guys too, because they're sweet guys. They're pretty honest and stuff like that. So you should really elevate them. And so they get promoted as administrators over the province of Babylon while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. Notice Daniel's absent from this chapter 3. It's believed that he likely was on an errand to the king somewhere during the time that this was taking place. So Shadrach, verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves. Okay? That is not necessary. We do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God that we serve, you say that no one can save us from the fiery furnace, but the God that we serve can. He is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. Notice they do not say he will deliver us from the furnace. There's a differentiation there. Yes, he is able to deliver us from the furnace, but that does not mean that he will deliver us from the furnace, but in either case, he will deliver us from your hand. Why? Because we recognize that there's more to come. We recognize that this is not where it's all at. We recognize that there's more to come. Verse 18. But even if he does not, our God who is able to take care of this, even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. What a contrast to what we find in Exodus 32. Exodus 32, where they say, Moses is dead. Let's make for ourselves our own God. That way we are in control of it. We've made it. We get to worship it. We get to choose whether our God lives or whether our God dies. And this is what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego realize. We can't control this God. We recognize he's powerful enough to do it. We don't get to choose what he does. However, we think he can do it. In fact, we know he can do it. But even if he does not, we're not bowing down to your puny 90-foot-tall God. In Hebrews 11, we get this short picture. You know, Hebrews 11, if you're familiar with it, this is kind of the faith chapter that we find in the scriptures. In Hebrews 11, you see Paul, well, it's believed to be Paul. It could be someone else that wrote it too, but many scholars believe it was Paul that wrote it. It makes no difference here nor there. But they see people like Abraham, and they'll emphasize Abraham had great faith, and it was through faith that Rahab, and it was through faith that Noah. So you have all these people mentioned in the Old Testament of faith. When we get to this brief picture where it's pointing to Daniel, where Paul is pointing to Daniel, he says, who shut the mouths of the lions, which is referring to Daniel chapter 6, and quenched the fury of the flames. And so no matter what happened to these guys, it was through faith that led them to make the decision that they had made. So in verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach and Meshach. So basically, Shadrach, these three guys, they said, Nebuchadnezzar, we're not going to do that. Even if, our God can save us from that, but even if he doesn't, we would never do what it is that you're asking us to do. Nebuchadnezzar gets furious. Who are you? You just cut me off on the highway. Who do you think you are? I'm God. I get to retaliate. I get to be the one that decides who does what and what not and why for. That's my job. And so Nebuchadnezzar is furious, and his attitude toward them changed. So he goes from a position of wanting to find a way, hey, if you guys will just submit to me here, we're going to be fine. His attitude changed. Forget the submission. Your time is up. It's over. And he ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual. You know, that some will say that that's just, you know, exaggeration, hyperbole. Maybe. But these furnaces would have been controlled with bellows. And so one theory is behind it. So with a set of bellows, the bellows are what you find in the old-time fireplaces where you have a wood fireplace, not a gas fireplace, and you have to put air in it. When we were a kid growing up, we had a wood fireplace, but we didn't have bellows, and so we would use Mom's hair dryer. And so we would take, when the fire wouldn't get going, we'd take the hair dryer, we'd plug it in, and we would just blow it on it, and then it would get ash all into her hair dryer, and then she'd go and use it in the morning, and she'd come out grayer than she was before. True. But anyway, it's kind of funny. But anyway, so that worked. It was wonderful bellows because you just run the hair dryer on it. But the idea of it was when you add that extra oxygen, the fire gets hotter. And so it's believed that perhaps Nebuchadnezzar ordered 7 bellows now in this furnace. Get that thing hot. I mean, I want it hot, hot. And so they could have brought in these extras. That could be what we're looking at here. That's also the number 7 is the number of perfection. We don't exactly know, but bottom line is he was angry enough to say, get that thing hotter. And then he throws him in. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement. This is another awe moment for the king. You'd think that he would learn. He won't learn yet. We'll see a little bit more next week. It's really kind of fun to look at what the Lord does in changing his heart and his mind. He's still got that heart of stone that has not been converted to a heart of flesh yet, despite the fact that he's seen the amazing signs of God over and over. Reminds you of the New Testament, doesn't it? Reminds you of the Gospels. When Jesus Christ is walking this earth and you have all these people asking, show us a sign, show us a sign, show us a sign. And Jesus gave them plenty of signs to validate his divinity. And yet they didn't want to follow him. They just wanted the signs. Nebuchadnezzar is very similar. Just give me an ah moment. It leaves me like, wow, that was a really cool trick. So King Nebuchadnezzar leaps to his feet in amazement and he asks his advisors, hey, guys, weren't there 3 guys that we tied up and threw into the furnace? They replied, certainly, yes, there was 3. We could count that high, at least. Even with our elementary education, we can get to 3. He said, look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire. They're unbound and unharmed, and one of them is all shiny-like. One of them is all, like, he looks like he's a son of the gods. There's an ah moment. Nebuchadnezzar sees it, and it's like, what's going on? Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and he shouted to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Notice there he says it again, Most High God. He recognizes that there is a powerful God at work here. And yet he will stay in awe, but will not submit to it. He cannot take and set his pride aside. Come out. Come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Obviously, an awe moment, a miraculous work. Therefore, Nebuchadnezzar said, I decree that the people of this nation, of any nation or language, who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, will be cut to pieces, and their houses turned to rubble. Isn't that interesting? I mean, you see this change of worship from verse 1 and 2, 3, 4, 5. It's like, okay, worship this idol that I have set up, and now that he recognizes where this real God is, he switches it, but he still doesn't have a repentant spirit. There's your evidence right here, because he's basically, this has nothing to do with following this God. It's just recognizing that this God is powerful. And so he says, wow, this is a really cool trick that you just had. And so now I'm ordering everyone. It's not this idea of you should worship this God because he's all powerful. You will worship this God or you'll be cut into pieces. And he misses this reality. He still thinks he's in control. You follow that? He recognizes God for who he is, but he still thinks he's in control. How many of that of us does that describe? You know what I mean? I mean, if we're going to be real honest, yes, I think most of us recognize God is all powerful, but yet we hold on to the control that we want to hold on to. It comes to our children, it comes to our parents, and it comes to at work, it comes to church. We want to hold the control. We want to hold the control. And yet what we fail to see is there's more to come, and we've never had control. We have a God who is almighty. He's going to work out. He's going to do what he wants to do. He's going to do some things in our lives that are going to make us very uncomfortable. But he's doing it because he's got something better in mind. So Nebuchadnezzar says, you guys either worship this God Almighty or you'll be cut into pieces. Your house is turned to piles of rubble because no other God can serve in this way. He recognizes God's power, but yet fails to see what it means to follow this God. Backing up one verse in verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted, I love this word, they trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve and worship any god except their own. We look at this, and oftentimes we try to align with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Will you give up your life for the sake of Christ? I'd like to say yes. I would hope that most of us would all be able to say yes, but the reality of it is maybe we would, maybe we wouldn't. When we look at this story, somehow we get this idea that if I will trust in God, that my life will be spared from the fires. That's not the case. God would not have been any less glorified if Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been burned up. Because you could still look at the evidence of their faith. You could still look at the evidence of their trust and say, those guys believed in God Almighty. And they had more to come. And likewise, we have more to come. Your lives are going to be filled with fiery times. You know, some of us have experienced it. Some of us maybe have not. Some of us have perhaps dealt with some things that we don't know how we could ever get through. Some of us are dealing with some things right now. Whatever the case is, we deal with stuff in our lives. But what we find is, in the scriptures, you find that God allows these fiery times to come into our lives. Yes, sometimes he'll deliver us from them, just as he did here. What an amazing picture. Leaves us in awe. But will you still follow that God, whether he had burned him up? And my answer wants to be yes. I want to follow that God whether they lived, whether they died. I want to follow the God whether I live, whether I died. I want to follow the God whether I have all of my life go by nice and smooth or that's full of hardship. There's in our backyard, we have a jack pine tree. I'm not exactly fond of pine trees in general. But jack pines, because they have these big pine cones and then they fall. And pine cones don't decay very quickly. But what's interesting about the jack pine, so you have these tight pine cones like this. Are you guys familiar with what these jack pines, anything about them? It's really interesting. So the reality of it is, that's where the seeds are, is inside the pine cone. If you remember your, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, you know, earth biology classes, that's where the seeds are. In order for those seeds to get out, something has to happen. They have to open up and they actually have to fall out. Well, with the jack pine, what's interesting is there's really only one way that those cones open. They're kind of sealed with a rosin. And the only way for those cones to open is they have to get hot. And once they get hot enough, then they start to open up. Now, it is some of these jack pines, the lower cones, if they get like a hot summer day, if it's like 81 degrees with the sun reflecting off of the earth and things like that, they can get hot enough where some of those lower cones will open. But for the most part, none of these cones, pine cones, will open until a forest fire. And that opens up the seeds. So what appears to be through destruction, what appears to be through extreme trial and heat, God does something pretty cool. So I don't know what fires and trials you're facing. I know there's some of you who are dealing with cancer. I know there's some of you who are dealing with pain. I know there's some of you dealing with other aches and life circumstances that are very difficult. And I'm not diminishing any of those. But the reality of it is, God, as he promised to these Israelites, he says, make your home, through Jeremiah chapter 29, he wrote that letter to all these exiles, make your home there. Invest in there. It's going to be hard. 70 years, I'm going to bring you back. Not everyone goes back. Daniel stays the whole time. But no matter what you face, even if you were to die in that fiery furnace, I'm doing something good. John chapter 12, verse 24 says it. Jesus says it like this. He's referring to himself in that sense. Unless a seed falls to the ground and dies, it remains only but a single seed. But if it dies, it flourishes, it grows, it becomes something. And likewise, sometimes God wants to use the fires that he's placed in our lives to help us to let go of our control and let him have the control that he has.